I joked with you that before we started the show, Jared, that you should have been born like in 1946, not 1964, whatever year you were born in.
Right. But 71.
71. Okay. Yeah. So.
But you're right. And you know that you brought that up because a lot of the argument that I've tried to develop in this book is taking some very at this point old theoretical approaches and trying to revive them.
I guess they are old. The 60s are old now, but yeah,
the 60s are old. I mean, you know, and to a certain extent, you know, as I say, you know, internal colonialism as a model of analysis goes back even longer than that. But yeah, you know, trying. But you all had it right. Your generation had it right.
But let's talk about this. Sure. Theory. Let's begin with this theory of internal colonialism and then go and talk a bit in how that fits into mixtape.
Sure.
So why don't you just have at it for that?
I mean, just the I guess the short version is that rather than arguing that Black America suffers from a deficiency of democracy in the United States or that the United States is a flawed democracy, I'm trying to argue that the theoretical approach that best suits the situation for Black people, for Latinos, and many others in this country and around the world is internal colonialism, is that the United States is an empire. Many people talk about it as an empire, but I don't think enough discussion proceeds from that saying, well, if it's an empire, what does an empire create? And empires create colonies and subjects as opposed to free citizens and democracies. So I'm just arguing that borrowing this theoretical approach that goes back at least as far as Martin Delaney in the middle of the 1800s, up through, as you were saying, more prominently used for Black Americans and Chicanos and others in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, to say that we are an internal colony and that the principles of colonization, of colonialism, are more appropriate to the situation than, as I said a moment ago, trying to look at it as a flawed democracy. So that is to say just basically that Black people remain to this day in a de facto distinct situation in terms of, you know, spatially distinct, socially distinct, and where the politics and economics of those communities are controlled by dominant forces outside of those communities, much like a mother country would a colony.
Well, and so in just to push the argument some, mm-hmm. I mean, sure. so how is we can explain it in terms of race and racism in America? Mm-hmm. That's a piece of this. Mm-hmm. But the other question that ties into that, how is that different than the colonization or oppression or rule by those in power to any community in this society? I mean, it's, you know what I'm saying? I mean, mm-hmm. it's not nobody, people control less and less of
That's right.
their own means, whether it's the media or their music or their neighborhoods or their schools or whatever that is. And they can be somebody white, Black, Latino,
right.
Mexican, Puerto Rican,
no,
Native American.
Right. So all I tried to do was update Albert Memmi's colonial pyramid of petty tyrants that he developed 40, 50 years ago as a Tunisian Jew, looking at the situation where he was, saying, yeah, I'm a Jew and I'm in Tunisia and I'm not maybe, you know, I'm not the freest, you know, and the most powerful perhaps in this society, but I'm certainly higher on the pyramid or the social hierarchy than the Arab population and the Muslim population. So he was just simply saying, as I'm arguing today, and you're right, we're all subsumed within this colonial experience. Now, it plays itself out differently for different communities. It has different levels of impact. It has, you know, more or less severe impact on different people depending where you are on that pyramid. So we even provide that, you know, little diagram in the book of a pyramid.
You do? Yes, you do.
So just to try to isolate that so people can find themselves on that pyramid and then understand to what extent they have or do not have power relative to other people on the pyramid. And then, but again, to make the point that if this is a colonial situation, and in terms of media making, which is what my focus here, or interpretation or analysis of media, we have to understand those colonial principles. The principles of colonialism and imperialism apply, as opposed, again, to this idea of free democracy, free citizenry, with some flaws here and there around the edges.
And is that theory, before we get into the heart of some of the stuff you're talking about, and I'm going to have this Kwame Ture quote that I want to start off with here,
sure.
that you have in your book. Does that mean that, from your perspective, that democracy in America, as a multiracial democracy, with people in control, is an impossibility?
I don't know about an impossibility. I'm saying it doesn't exist. And that if we want to make it a reality, then we have to acknowledge that it doesn't exist and engage upon a number of different things to organize what does exist out of existence and develop something else. But that's sort of the point I'm trying to make, or one of the points I'm trying to help others make, because I'm not alone in this by any means, that to the extent that people keep going back to this notion of we live in a multiracial, multi-ethnic, more or less free and equal democracy, I think it inhibits our the choices we make, the moves we make politically, the people we vote for, the parties we develop. All of these things get negatively impacted. And then the conclusions people draw and the analyses people develop out of that, I think, are equally flawed and lead us back to the lack of progress that I'm arguing now, which is one of the points I'm trying to say, that you know, as you're going to bring up this Kwame Ture quote and many others, you know, who I'm quoting from 30, 40, 50, 60, even more years ago, is saying that all the things that they were arguing and trying to organize us out of still exist. And to the extent that we don't buy into that or acknowledge that or believe it or see it, we are equally stagnant, you know, and equally in many ways going backwards. We're devolving in many ways. I mean, a lot of the gains that your generation brought us are being wiped out, if or close to it.
Dr. Jared Ball, associate professor here at Morgan State University. His book is I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, 410-319-8888.
Can I just say real quick before you move on?
Yeah.
My favorite thing about promoting this book, and I want people to go to imixwhatilike.com for more information, is that every penny that we make from the sale of this book goes to political prisoners. I'm not going to make a penny from this book, and I don't want to make a penny. We're going to try to use this to fundraise to get people to become more aware of political prisoners and the situations around that. I know you've done interviews around this. And we want to help get them some money and some attention. So whatever little contribution I can make, I'm happy to do that.
That was interesting. There's an interesting quote you have in this book. I don't know if I marked it off or not, but it had to do with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Right, right.
And why he did not free
Stanley Tukey Williams.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah,
whose brother
12.
I've interviewed. But
oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that in the archives? I'm going to have to go
it
check
is in the
that
archives.
Out. I'm going to go check that
it's
out.
It's a long way away. It's like in the 1990s somewhere.
We'll find it.
It's there.
I love it. I'm a researcher, right? I'll find it.
But you have this quote. That's one of the reasons he would not spare his assassination, because the people he said that he cared about were people like Leonard Peltier and others who are sitting in prison as political prisoners.
That's right. And you know, he says that because Stanley Tukey Williams had given credit and had dedicated his book to people like Nelson Mandela and Angela Davis and Malcolm X and Assata Shakur and the recently passed Geronimo G. Jaguar Pratt.
Just died.
Just died. Ramona Africa, John Africa, Peltier. You mentioned Daruba Al-Mujahid, Bin Wahad, and George Jackson, who was one of my favorites. And Mumia, Schwarzenegger saying this man is not redeemed and therefore deserves the death he was originally sentenced to get. So the point I'm just trying to make is that, you know, all around us, you know, and in many ways, you know, the book is kind of written in like a mixtape in that it's a collage of all these ideas and people who've influenced me the same way a DJ would put together a mixtape. But it's also to say that in this case, that to the extent that we deny the power of ideology and the power of ideas, we miss the point. And I think that this is what he's saying. And it was to me, as I said here, an explicit statement in defense of colonialism as possible. And very quickly, colonialism just simply means that a group is to be controlled socially, politically, culturally, and economically by a more distant and powerful group. And that's, in its simplest form, that's all I'm saying here. So we don't have legitimate integration socially in terms of living, and certainly in terms of wealth and income. Black America, in this case, leads a very distinct and different experience in life from most of white America and vice versa. And its power is controlled externally. So and I'm saying that the ideas that govern the society, that dominate the nation, in fact, the world, accept this and promote this kind of relationship and defend it. And that's what Schwarzenegger was saying here. And I admit to getting more pleasure than I should from his recent troubles. But, you know, I mean, you know, like same thing with the what's his name, Khan of the IMF. And all
well, there's
them
or there's people who are progressives like me. You know, it seems to always that has a lot to do to me with the blatancy of male power and what men think they can do.
No doubt. No doubt about it.
And what becomes more important with somebody like Wiener, who's fighting for every progressive cause he can in the U.S. Congress, and then does this? To think that this new age of media, they're not going to find out?
The first, speaking of dear brother, you know, the first thing I thought of when he got in this trouble was that, you know, this was one of the few people who was a strong, outspoken defender of real healthcare reform.
Right.
And all I kept thinking was, you know, not you, you know, the how, you know, it's a shame that you not only would do this, but then had to be caught, you know, probably should have expected it given the positions he took. And just a shame because he seemed like one of the few who was halfway decent up there.
And unafraid to stand up and.
That's right.
Oh, well.
Anyway.
Anyhow.
Right.
Kwame Ture, you wrote in your book, Black visibility is not black power.
That's right.
Towards the front of the book.
That's right.
Now, one of the things that makes me think of when you wrote that was the question of black and white in America. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of black visibility now.
That's right.
In what you might term the corporate class.
That's right.
The ruling class, whatever you want to call them. The president of American Express.
That's right.
Any number of people I can mention. So talk about it in that context. I mean, clearly is a powerful, growing, small.
Sure.
But.
Well, I mean, but again, you know, even as these few of members of the colonized reach these levels, including even the presidency of the United States, the community, the greater community itself is devolving. It's getting worse. Black people have less or the same 1% of 1/10 of 1% of the nation's wealth that was held in 1865. Losing billions or potential billions in wealth because of the home, you know, loan crisis. Long-term employment, it's as high as it's been since 1948, I think. Black male unemployment is as high as any level of unemployment in the world. So, I mean, you have, you know, conditions that mirror more overtly recognized colonized situations. If you compare Black America to many of the so-called third world communities around the world, and particularly in relationship to their dominant society, and put them in the context of the United States versus these colonies in the so-called third world, you see, I mean, there's little to be excited about. So that's what Ture was again so presciently warning us against, that the more visible blackness belies or denies the horrifically deteriorating conditions of the rest of the community. So it doesn't really matter that I could sit here or Obama could be in the president's in the White House, or so-and-so could be the CEO of this or that corporation. Very little of that has any positive impact on the rest of the community. It doesn't mean any more power. It doesn't translate into power. And in effect, translates into more power and more concentration of wealth in the top 1% and in the dominantly mostly white and male society.
I just want to throw this out here now. We'll get into it more in depth in the next 30, 40 minutes that we have here. But
sure.
you really go after, analytically speaking, not in person, but analytically speaking, public media mm-hmm. and some of the public media heroes and heroines that people have, mm-hmm. like Oprah, mm-hmm. like Tavis Smiley, mm-hmm. and even Amy Goodman. We'll get mm-hmm. to each one of these a little bit later. But
okay.
but that's, I mean, they're kind of who are in some ways icons of the public media mind.
That's right. Well, I mean, you know, and again, extending from that point that black visibility is not black power. I mean, you have Oprah presiding over a media empire that I just read in Richard Prince's Journalisms not long ago doesn't want to hire any black people or put any black people on TV. I mean, you have Tavis is brought up in the book only to talk about what he felt he was not able to do with National Public Radio, I believe. In terms of developing, an alternative version of blackness that this society can't withstand, and it just goes back to this idea that as James Baldwin said, you know, when I hate using the phrase the N-word, but
anyway, that word's kind of as banned on the station.
Yeah, I hear you. I just want to put that out there.
I hate
using it because as I think Dick Gregory said. You know, I don't want to use the L word for lynched because I could never be an N, but I could be lynched. And I think his point is valid here. But anyway. I forgot what I was just going to say. What were we just saying?
We were talking about Oprah, Tavis, and the you were talking about how Oprah would not hire anybody after black.
Yeah, it was about to be so deep, too. It was about to be the most powerful thing ever said on the air, and I completely lost it. But basically, essentially just extending from this idea that black visibility is not black power, that you have, that's what I was going to say. James Baldwin once said that when a white man calls me an N, I ask him why you need me to be one. because I'm clearly not that. But if I'm not that, then you are not who you say you are, and then everything falls apart. And that's really what colonialism and this model is meant to highlight, that the version of blackness that is made popular is one that is of necessity, one that is supportive or cajoles the views of blackness that those in power have of black people. So Oprah is there, and Janice Peck did a great book on this, The Age of Oprah as a Neoliberal Icon.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, I mentioned that, yeah. She did a great job of really getting into detail. And Daphne Brooks, who I also mentioned in the book, her essay from Kevin Powell's anthology in the early 2000s, really exposing Oprah as, serving the role of appeasing mostly affluent white women, that is her target audience and base. And providing for her black audience and really for the nation a very neoliberal conservative outlook. She is certainly not someone who advocates any sort of radical or black radical positions or raises serious critical questions about the structure of society and so on. So the same thing, again, is what I've said about what I've mentioned about Tavis, at least is in struggling with his position at NPR, trying to overcome. Unsuccessfully, by his own estimation, and then saying that, look, we have not enough media space for alternative versions of politics, cultural expression, ideas to be expressed, and that those who are perceived to be in these positions of access or in positions where they could change that really don't, and they're not able to. So I mean, it's not even just to pick on them individually.
No. But the quote you have here is the, which I just found it, which you're talking about Oprah. The quote is,
when she says she's not going back to the schools.
When
right.
In January of 2007, Oprah Winfrey popularly stated that, quote, "If you're a child in the United States, you can get an education. I became so frustrated with visiting inner city schools that I just stopped going. The sense that you need to learn more, learn just isn't there. If you ask the kids what they want or need, they'll say an iPod or some sneakers. In South Africa, they don't ask for money or toys. They ask for uniforms so they can go to school." So I remember that.
Yeah.
When that particular thing happened.
Now, what I'm handing you right now is the official companion mixtape that goes with the book.
Oh, cool.
And when you look and when you check it out, I forgot what number it is, but there's a track by Odyssey, who's a D.C.-based artist, and he's got a track on there called Camera. And in his third verse, he talks about Oprah making that statement. And his point, if I understood him correctly, the point that I'm making is that how could young black kids want anything else, given the media environment that they're subsumed within, given what's promoted toward them, including what Oprah promotes. You know, what is the overriding view of Oprah that people are meant to get? Buy this, have that, live this life, smile all the time, you know, you'll be successful, so on and so forth. And then just trying to make the point, as Fanon did many years ago, that this sort of apathy that she's describing is, the as he describes it, the inertia, the colonial inertia that presses against people, that presses against the colonized and forces them into positions of apathy or confusion or lack of direction. So it's not so much that it's the fault of these children, right? Because, of course, who would blame children for the flaws of a society? I mean, that's just off the top of my, just on the surface, insane. It's what these children in many ways are forced to deal with in terms of media, not to mention the rest of the problems that they are confronted by. And then Oprah doesn't change this up. She is not an alternative to encourage different forms of belief or practice or appreciation for education. Not to mention if she spent real time in public schools. I was a public school teacher briefly. I mean, there's very little in there that to promote, a desire for learning among the students, not to mention the teachers and the staff and themselves. So, anyway, so I'm not a big fan of Oprah, and I just wanted to take, and to me, as soon as she made that statement, to me, it was almost like the media equivalent of the levees breaking in New Orleans. I mean, this should have been the last straw. For black people and their relationship to this woman, or any well-meaning person and their relationship to this woman. But should have been the last straw, and they should have seen that now we have really got to come up with something different
here. Not that I want to stay on this particular issue, because I want to come back to the stuff in the book, but one of the things that, and get to the phones here, 410-319-8888, we will come to your calls here in a minute, is that I can hear a lot of people thinking, wait. What people like Oprah Winfrey and others do is open doors to a larger world outside the black community that's important for change, that she enters into these dialogues and conversations that begins to seep into the consciousness of white America, that things are different, you know, when you have a black heroine being Oprah in her majority white audience.
But more of what she does, and again, Janice Peck and Daphne Brooks have done a better job of this. I didn't really spend too much time on it either. But really what she does is she provides the very popular hyper-mammy role in society. She makes people feel good. She makes white, affluent America feel good. She makes the settler, the colonizer, feel comfortable. This is, of course, the traditional role for people like Oprah in the experience of colonization.
So then, if you were producing Oprah,
right?
I'm serious.
Yeah.
If you or something similar to that, what would you be doing instead?
Oh man, we would be doing a lot of things that actually we're trying to put together in another venture that I'm involved in.
All right, we'll talk about what you would do then.
Well, we would have radical. Artists on, the political artists who are intentionally kept off the airwaves. We would have them on to perform and discuss their work. We would have a whole different, really all you need to do is reset the people you call. And this is actually what emancipatory journalism, the other part of the book,
I was about to ask you about bring that word up.
Is that and Hemant Shah is a professor in Madison, Wisconsin, who came up with this phrase in the initial study of what he calls emancipatory journalism. And I actually found it while I was a PhD student at the University of Maryland in a stack of communication theories journals set to be thrown away. And it was in many ways very appropriate for the way academia deals with this wing of thought. But he's basically just arguing that for colonized populations, they need a philosophy of journalism that is very different than the popular model we have in the United States. And basically he's just saying, and we talk about it in the book, and we use one of his models to make the point that you just have to reset who are the pundits, who are the experts, who are the people you interview. And it's in many ways just that simple. I've heard you do it with this program. A lot of other good programmers do the same thing. The very people you bring in and have take part in the discussion that you ask the questions of. Determine the direction and the content of the program in many ways. So, you know, that would be just simply put, that would be what I would do. And I would invite people on that she would not invite on and make them the standard for the discussion. Make them those who set the acceptable parameters for the discussion on a show like that.
So if you were to describe for our listeners and DeConte and others, I'm going to come to your calls here. I just want to get some things on the ground
before
you open the phones. If you were to describe the difference, as you do in this book in a few chapters, between this idea of emancipatory journalism, on the one hand, and what people get on places like National Public Radio, which you call this kind of liberal journalism that doesn't get to the place it needs to get to, though people think it does, from your perspective.
Yeah.
So talk about define that.
Well, again, you know, what national, and even what we argue in the book, borrowing from my friend Chris Tinson, Professor Chris Tinson, who came up with this idea in an interview we were doing some years ago to connect these two. But National Public Radio does what Fanon says Radio Algiers did in Algeria during French colonization.
Can we take a sidebar here?
Sure.
Sidebar is, for those who don't know, and some people do, some people don't,
right.
France Fanon was a Martinique-born psychiatrist who was a revolutionary and a thinker, a theorist, who wrote incredible books like Wretched of the Earth, talked about mass psychology and what it does to people throughout the Third World. And he was deeply involved in the Algerian Revolution.
That's right.
And
thank you.
So just to let people know who he was.
And one of the best writers, most brilliant people to ever walk the earth. And his name is brought up so often, but his analysis is so rarely applied. That was one of the things that I wanted to try to do with this book, is to say not
There's a lot of Fanon in your book.
I love Fanon. And a lot of people say they love Fanon, but they don't actually want to apply because it's scary. I mean, it's honestly scary because the conclusions he reaches, very few of us want to reach or are comfortable reaching. Less of us are comfortable reaching and discussing publicly for our careers, safety, and other reasons. So to a certain extent, I've even mentioned in the book, I cop out and say that I'm making a media argument, a safe media argument, to stand up in place of his more concrete, radical, political, you know, argument that he's making. But simply put, I'm just saying that the National Public Radio does, as he said, that Radio Algiers did for France. It makes the settler feel comfortable. It makes the colonization process seem acceptable, normal, the standard, perfectly okay, and that the settler is right that they're in their rightful place. That's why it has its tone. That's why it reaches its it targets a certain audience. That's why certain politics are either ignored or brought up and dismissed and destroyed, in, you know, intentionally. But it's here to provide the nation and the white liberal mainstream nation, you know, the appearance of real news and journalism, but it's really there just to make them feel good. So what I'm saying is, and what Hemant Shah was saying with emancipatory journalism is that the colonized have nobody coming for them. And that's why I took a few pages, at least, to talk about, you know, the Amy Goodmans of the world and the white left, who many of us have such a greater hope for, but they're really not coming in terms of offering news and media space for the most colonized, most oppressed in the society. So the ultimate argument that I'm making here is that the mixtape, the tradition of the rap music and hip-hop mixtape, could be applied or be made into a space for emancipatory journalism to take place, so that people in their own local communities can begin to develop a press, a journalism that is culturally viable, culturally relevant to the young, to the histories of Black America, to the specific tradition and relationship Black America has to radio in general, and then can use this mixtape and this underground method of distribution as an alternative to the many more harmful media products that they have more easily and more readily at their disposal.
It's a really interesting and complex question to me that you raised in this book about all that. About Amy, who I have a lot of respect for. We'll talk a bit about what you said about her.
I do, too. Absolutely. Go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, because her program's not about America. It's more about the world than it is about this country.
That's right.
And that the NPR, which I've been associated with for the last 18 years,
right,
on one level or another, I don't disagree completely with your analysis of, mm-hmm. of what it does, mm-hmm. And especially with that at least on the purely on racial issues, not say class, but racial issues, mm-hmm. that when you hear African American or Latino hosts on public radio, they can always find voices of communities of color to talk about anything under the sun, from astrophysics to biology, to politics, to whatever,
right?
But on the shows that are mostly run by white NPR staffers, they can't seem to find those people to come on the air to talk about any subjects.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? So that's to be an issue. And the other one is, though, that NPR, and we'll take a break here and get to the phones, Baba, DeConte, Ann, and that order are going to come right to you as soon as we come back from the break, is that they also, though, don't they serve a purpose on another level? They do open doors. Now, when you say that in the book that like an average NPR listener maybe make $80,000 a year, $86,000, family income of $86,000. Well, to a person in a poor community, that's a huge amount of money.
That's a lot of money.
But a family income of $86,000 means that you are probably two school teachers, mm-hmm. or a carpenter and a school teacher, mm-hmm. or a nurse and a construction worker. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's not as if that $86,000 represents somebody who's sitting on top of the food chain.
Sure, sure. No, but I'm just simply saying that, and I'm trying to find the pages right now. But
I can find the pages. I have them all marked off here.
but the exact numbers, you know. No, I understand the point that you're making, but I am saying here.
This page.
118.
Yeah.
What they're doing is what I'm also saying is that beyond just maybe this school teacher and carpenter that you're describing is that that the general tone, the target, the intention, the intended audience, and the intention of the message, the intention behind the message is here to design to give those settlers, the more affluent, a comfort zone that they shouldn't have.
We'll come back to let's make to the discomfort zone in emancipatory journalism. Dr. Jared Ball, author of the book "I Am Mixed What I Like: A Mixtape Manifesto." 410-319-8888. Baba, DeConte, Ann. When we return, we're going to go 1, 2, 3 to get your voices on the air with us. Stay with us. We are now here with Dr. Jared Ball, author of the new book "I Am Mixed What I Like: A Mixtape Manifesto." He's here at Morgan State University, an associate professor of communication studies, founder and producer of Free Mix Radio. 410-319-8888. I'll do as I promised. Baba, DeConte, and in that order, Baba, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
How are you doing?
Welcome.
And to your guest, too. I really enjoy the spirit of the brother that you have here, the professor at Morgan. He has the same type of spirit of Jesse McDade Bay and Ambrose Lane. Jesse McDade Bay had that same type of spirit. And as far as colonization, and Oprah Winfrey is a nanny, and I would give her the same name that Malcolm gave, House Negro. And it's a lot of them running around here, like he said. Being colonized here, the proof that I'm going to give you is Connie, one of the so-called Chief Justice, say that a white man, a black man, African had no respect, no rights that a white man should respect. And when you have a government that puts out a 25-year verdict that African people, that white people have to give the approval for African people to vote. I was in Philadelphia during that move situation where the Republic of New Africa put Wilson Good, that criminal. Hello?
Go ahead, man. Finish your thoughts.
Put Wilson Good on trial. There was a trial for Wilson Good's crime. And is he still teaching at Morgan?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure. Well, I'd just like to say this, brother. You are one of the very few that I hear basically on this station that has the type of courage.
Baba, finish up.
Basically, to tell it like it is. And obviously, you don't have that House Negro mentality. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I just one quick point. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the names to which I was just connected. But I just want to say very quickly that I don't want this to be lost in this discussion, but I don't pick on Oprah and other people to pick on them as individuals or put any blame on them. I point to them to make the point about the function that we are all made to play in a society and the function that media play in the society. So when I make a point about an artist or somebody like Oprah, it's not to just pick on them as an individual and make it all about them. Oprah is not the cause of all of our problems. I'm just using her as an example of how this society functions. And colonialism calls for the appropriation of members of the colonized to become part of the process of colonizing the rest. I mean, this is as old as imperialism is itself. So it shouldn't be surprising that we would find, I mean, it's the same thing why you have black elected officials coming from black communities, or you have certain, people like Oprah or even Obama selected from among the colonized, more or less, and then used to further the process of colonialism. So I just, want to make that point very quickly.
410-319-8888 DeConte, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome.
Yes, thank you very much. I say this at the risk of being wrong because I never heard of this brother, but I am 100% dubious of the black intellectual class putting out this kind of rhetoric that I think, it can be.
Hold on, DeConte. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, just look at Cornel West. Cornel West said a lot of derogatory things about the president. Just because that he wasn't invited to the table. The last thing that I want to say is that
Go ahead.
Hello. Sorry. Okay. Right quick. The last thing I want to say is that capitalism clearly, states that you don't think about race. You think about yourself. How much money. Look at Bob Johnson, BET. He made all his money, and then he sold it. And you see this kind of formula, being followed, by a lot of people. So we need to critique capitalism, not necessarily. Are people black enough? Okay.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments. I mean, first of all, let me just say I completely agree with the baseline viewpoint that the caller brings that he should be, and many should be, skeptical of people like me. Should be skeptical of scholars. They should. I mean, absolutely. So I am just as I am of everyone else. So I think that's absolutely wonderful, and you should continue to be skeptical of me and anyone else until you see the real conditions of your community change. And this is why where I would agree with Cornel West. And let me just say this very quickly. Unfortunately, a lot of what goes on within academia doesn't make it to the outside world, which is, I'm sure, the case with a lot of professions. Within academia, there are a lot of debates and arguments, a lot of different camps, a lot of different spaces that we occupy. And I would not And I don't think that anyone who understood who I am or my work would ever put me in the camp of Cornel West or vice versa. But at the same time, I think that we shouldn't lose sight of whatever his, you know, I don't know why he made the comments about Obama that he made. I think his criticism is justified and valuable. And my criticism of Obama would probably be much worse and much farther to the left than Cornel West. And certainly not because I expected to be invited to the White House and I'm just angry. But at the same time, you know, so I do think that there should be room for the differences to be heard and that academics should be judged as anybody else be judged on our work and not just the positions that we hold. And then ultimately we all should be judged. And this is sort of the point I'm trying to make with the book, that we should all be judged by the lack or absence of change in our lives or in the communities that we come from. And that's what I think should be the ultimate judge of me, of Cornel West, of Obama, and anybody else. Have the real conditions of people in this country. And then the last point I just want to make responding to the caller is that, as I say in the book, Kwame Nkrumah, another one of the most brilliant minds that gets excluded from most popular discussions, said himself that capitalism is domestic colonialism. So it isn't. So colonialism to me, as I just briefly make the point in the book, is the perfect synthesis of the sort of race, class, culture, gender divisions that exist. And I think that the approach of colonialism is Fanon and Memmi and Sartre to a certain extent even, and certainly Kwame Ture and Malcolm X and many others, Robert Allen, the way they applied these theories and these theoretical approaches, they were very clear that this is a synthesis of race, class, and culture. It deals with all of those issues simultaneously and I think equally well. So it's not an absence of a critique of capitalism. It's just simply to say that it's not just about money, and that's one of the points that I try to make in the book, that capitalism isn't just about money, and Marx and Engels said that themselves.
410-31, well, thank you so much for your call, 410-319-8888, and you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I am so glad and impressed to hear you, young man. I don't want to call you young, but I'm 57 years old. So just to hear you bring this discussion up today, I read that brother when I was in my early 20s, Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, Black Skin, White Man, Dr. Samuel Yeti. And it all still comes to the fact that they were saying when you have colonialism, you attack the women. Once you can control the women, because the women are the ones who set the standards and how you upraise the population. And when I see what the nation of women have raised up and to take over the community today, it's sad, sad, sad. And that's why you have a lot of unruliness within the children, because the women were not educated. We don't read anymore. I mean, we're just walking around with our heads in the clouds. How can you be a possible mother of anybody and not a read, well-learned, educated woman? So you have to pass that on. So when I hear you talk, brother, I am really impressed, and I thank you for opening up the airways to let me know that there are some people out there that's thinking, you know, we are not, you know, sitting in the cloud, you know, waiting for what, I don't know. But he had a seminar out here at Silver Springs on Frantz Fanon, in fact, at the, what's the name of the theater?
Who had the seminar?
Who had the seminar?
Yeah, were you there? Yeah, so there was a seminar out there. So, I mean, you know, there's people that are conscious that's about to wake up. If not now, when? And that's my little sidebar. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Now, I mean, you know, I think the credit, at least for the airwaves, I mean, has to go to Mark here and to WEAA. And I think to the extent that people support this kind of, and this is another point of the book, that we have to, you know, I'm arguing that the mixtape be used as this underground emancipatory source of journalism and media making. But I think that another point of the book, and that I also just try to make in general, is that we have to be much more supportive of alternative media in as many different forms as possible. And one of the things that we talk about very briefly is also that the internet is not the answer too, which is another controversial point. I think sometimes even more so than the argument about colonialism, that the internet is just not the answer. And I think that one simple way, and we don't have that much time, but one simple way I think that people could use to I think works for me at least, is that whether we're talking about Oprah or Obama or the internet or me, you know, our presence, our work has not done anything to lessen the kinds of horrific inequality we see in this world. And I think if that is the standard, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to keep using this and focus on this issue of colonialism, that as long as we don't lose sight of the fact of the intentional nature behind the inequality in this world, I think we have hope to deal with it. But it's when people keep We are encouraged. We are in many ways, the ideas are imposed on us to see the inequality in the world as the fault of those least powerful, least among us, as opposed to intentional policies. And this is why, again, I quote Derrick Bell in the book with one of the most powerful quotes I've ever read, which is where he basically says that the public policy that this country has set up is tantamount to taking black people by the hundreds randomly to a secluded place and shooting them every week. And his point is that this is what our public policy's impact on the country, on black people, is, and that this is intentional. This is not an accident. This is not just the deficiencies of democracy or the you know, unintended consequences of capital accumulation. This is an intentional process, and that's why I'm arguing that, as you know, trying to borrow from Marx and Engels, and more importantly, Kwame Ture and Kwame Nkrumah, is that money exists. The chase for money exists as a distraction, as a euphemism, even for social dominance, for social order, social control over a majority of the people of the world. And whether it was done through money or whether some other form of hierarchy, you know, it's going to be done unless it's resisted and organized out of existence.
When people talk about emancipatory radio and trying to change the kind of conversation people are allowed to participate in the media, mm-hmm. And we have such a fragmented media in America.
That's right.
Really fragmented. How do you end up not talking to yourself?
Well, my argument is that, you know, again, I'm not with the Mixtape Radio Project. The goal isn't to talk to a broad mass audience. The goal is to talk to locally specific, regional even communities who already have a similar like mind, and to encourage greater organization. So, I think this is again one of the challenges of this position and even of this book, is that I'm not arguing that I or anyone else should be famous or that this should be a project that the world is following. In fact, I'm arguing that Mixtape Radio Project should be started in every location where there are DJs, every location where there are oppressed communities, that they should find the people who have similar or like minds and organize them. That is ultimately the point of the book as well, again, borrowing from Kwame Ture and many others, that it is only a lack of organization that's causing us the problems here, or is preventing us from wiping out the problems here. It's not necessarily that we need more people to know. Although that would help, I think that the real goal is to get people who are already claiming to be committed, who go to all the meetings we all go to get that same crowd that show up at all the functions that we go to be more organized and to act as an organized body in more in different ways to change things.
410-319-8888. Dr. Jared Ball is with us, Morgan State University professor. His book is I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto. And let me see here, who's on the longest? William, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to make an observation.
Mm-hmm.
The your guest has been very, I guess he's criticized the President Obama's time in office. And I guess that he feels that the president hasn't done enough to rectify the ills of this country and improve jobs and so forth and so on. But give them time. It didn't happen overnight, and I don't think any rational human being would expect it to change overnight. One of the things he talks about is colonialism, the Willie Lynch syndrome. They're still alive and well, even in black academia. Because there comes a time when we as a people have a strong sense of nationalism and play the game that the colonial leaders do. Sometimes when they don't like their leaders, they don't voice it. They'll hold their peace, because they will hold their peace and show public support for someone that they don't particularly agree with until they can find another viable candidate to take their place. Whereas with us, we seem to be quick to throw people under the bus, and we forget about the fact that this is a battle. This is a physical battle. This is a mental battle, and we have to be mentally strong and play the game. Lift them up.
Okay.
In private, we might want to talk about him, but far as the nation is concerned, we're behind him 100% because he's our president.
Jared?
I mean, I don't, you know, I feel like I've been more reserved than normal in my criticism of Obama on this program. So I haven't really said anything about Obama.
Yeah, you don't have to be reserved, man. You can say what you didn't want to say.
We don't have time for that. But what I would say, that and this is sort of, again, one of the points I actually try to address in this book is that similar but in disagreement with what the caller was just saying, if Obama, for instance, had been the product or the result of a black nationalist move, of an organized attempt within black America to promote a candidate who would speak best to black America's concerns, I would fully agree with what the caller said. And I probably wouldn't say anything publicly negative about the president. But the fact of the matter is, true to form in a colonial situation, President Obama is not at all the product of black America. He is the product of the most wealthy, powerful forces in this society. They funded him, backed him, and have assured that he would continue what they want to have happen. So my only point in that would be to say is that he is the perfect example of a neo-colonial president meant to be taken from, at least seemingly from, the population of the colonized and then used to worsen their condition.
Now, that would be, you know, that how can I put this question? There is a huge range in America of people who oppose the oppression that's going on in this society.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are on the left.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the left, clearly, right?
Mm-hmm. Way out.
You're out there. So, which is okay, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people from the progressive end of the spectrum who maybe even still in the Democratic Party, maybe outside of that organization and being independent, involved in electoral politics, and William, who just called, that those perspectives are very broad.
That's right.
You know, and that, so is it important to you in this notion to engage all that population? Or are you just attempting to engage the population you think you can organize to make something change from where you're looking?
In terms of this discussion of Obama?
The discussion about Obama made me think about what he was saying in regards to what you were saying and the broad spectrum of people in America. You know, and what you're thinking about with mixtape.
Right? Yeah, I think I got you. I mean, I think, you know...
I'm sorry for not being clear.
I might just not be catching it. You may be perfectly clear. I just think that... I'm not entirely sure, to be honest with you, and I'm not entirely sure. Obviously, I haven't figured all this out. Otherwise, we'd be free and equal, and this would be wonderful. Or, as I heard someone else say, I would be held up as the cause of the problem and dealt with accordingly. And I would agree with that if I knew what the problem was and hadn't shared it with everybody. But look, I don't know exactly what to do. I think that the best I can, I encourage people to really, in the example of Obama, really study his history. I mean, I feel like I've gone to a great length to study his background, to study his pre-election behavior, his post-election behavior, and I think that when I speak on these issues of Obama with some degree of I don't want to use a word authority, but it comes from real work, I would say. And I don't know that everybody who supports him puts in that same amount of work into studying his background or his current policy. So I would just encourage that people do that, and that we not simply... One of the reasons why I like this colonial model is that it does encourage people to not simply look at the color of somebody's skin in determining whether or not that person is best to represent their interests. And I think this is, again, why Kwame Ture said 50 years ago that black visibility is not black power, because he saw this as a trend. And the more that we see blackness being positioned in popular media and popular politics, the worse the conditions of the community get. And I think that this has to be looked at. And so, again, I'm not saying the same thing I said about Oprah. I'm not saying Obama is the problem.
Right.
I'm saying that he is, in fact, a symptom of the problem and has to be acknowledged as such and dealt with as such.
Let's go to Ibrahim. Last thought, very quickly. Ibrahim, you're on the air.
All right. Peace and blessings. First and foremost, I would like to say that, in my opinion, that, you know, colonialism and what we call racism, they're all shoots of a stronger pulse, which we can consider greed. And we could definitely say that the issues and concerns that we have are based on the monetary system that we exist in today. I also see, as an opinion, the leaders that we speak of in Nkrumah, specifically in Nkrumah, you know, when we deal with academics, not only did he study or become involved in academia, he put his academics to practice. You know, you can see the result in Ghana, expression of their culture and their economic capacity and their structure today. You know, last and not least, I would like to say, and in regards to humanity as a whole, I feel as though with the result of the division of people in regards to their economic class and their ability to prosper
right.
based on this foundation of greed, I think our best bet is to go back to our real resources. Academia is one aspect, but there's also the action aspect, and there's also that self-reflection, because we are the reflection of the Most High, all of us.
I have 30 seconds left. Didn't realize we were so up against the clock, but...
I mixwhatilike.com. Check out the book. That's exactly what I'm trying to make. The book is it not only is trying to change the discussion in hip hop and media studies, but it offers a practical example of what can be done in localized communities, and it's also self-critical of what our project has been able and not been able to do. So I encourage people to take it, make it run, and make it better, and use what we got to get what we want. And help some political prisoners. You can buy the book and hate on me and not even like the whole argument and still help somebody who deserves it and at least change up the argument and the debate a little bit. That's all we were trying to do. So thank you very much.
And I didn't mean to get this conversation digressing into Obama as much as we did.
That's right.
But it was good, though.
Yeah.
Dr. Jared Ball, I Mix What I Like, a mixtape manifesto. Jared, good to see you. Thank you so much
Likewise.
For being in the studio.
Thank you.
This is great. And then next time we have you on for a larger discussion, we'll make sure we give you a few days' notice so you can make it in here, okay?
As best we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you.